Welcome to the Rehab and Performance Lab, the MedBridge podcast where we dive into the world of orthopedics and sports. We're here to unpack the big topics, offering you practical insights and valuable tips from some of the most inspiring professionals in our field. Don't forget to visit MedBridge.com to get your continuing education credit for this episode, plus access bonus resources. Welcome to the Rehab and Performance Lab, where we have conversations about bridging the gap between research and real-world application. Oh, and you get CEUs too. I'm Phil Plisky, your host. I'm a professor and author at philplisky.com and a consultant in professional sports. Being a physical therapist, an athletic trainer, and strength and conditioning coach, I come at this from many different perspectives. We want this to be research-based, but more importantly, we want this to be really practical so you can use all the information that we're talking about. I'm excited about our topic today, managing expectations regarding timing after return to sport with ACL reconstruction. This is a hot topic, and I'm excited to discuss it. We're going to have a conversation with Dr. Kyle Matzel, who's an associate professor at the University of Evansville, Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, and he's the Program Director of the PhD in Health Professions Education, as well as Sports Residency Program. Welcome, Kyle. I'm so glad you're here.
Oh, thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Fantastic. Could you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. No, absolutely. So yeah, I'm a physical therapist, been a physical therapist for about 15 years now, which is crazy to think about. Time just really goes. In addition to all that, I got into academics about 8 years ago at the University of Evansville and, really just passionate about upping the level of physical therapy. My main mission for going back into academics was largely associated with, I thought that we could always be better as a profession and continue to bring evidence-based practice, to the masses and really help our patients that way. And I felt that best way to do that was go down to the ground roots with the young, hungry, passionate PT students and work with them. So I have that opportunity to work with them, every day, which is great. In addition to that, I'm the program director for the sports residency program. So get to work with sports residents, which is a whole nother level of complexity and expertise, which is great. And then, I picked up a PhD from University of Kentucky a few years ago, studying kind of arm care, injury prevention, risk factor management in baseball players. And now I'm the program director of our new PhD program at the University of Evansville, which is an online program in health professions education, which we're really excited about.
Oh, that's awesome. So I know you have a ton of area of passions. I know we've worked together on a lot of different things, but could you tell me a little bit more specifically about your passion for ACL reconstruction and kind of how that's developed over time?
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was an ACL patient myself. I mean, back when I was in college, I tore my ACL playing basketball and underwent surgery, rehabilitation, really the whole nine yards. And, again, as a college student, you get good care. And I got really great care while I was getting rehab. But, then you get into PT school and you start learning about the evidence. You start learning about all of the different, factors, physical, mental, and beyond. And you start thinking, wow, we can really up the level. We can really, push the limits and not only get people back to where they were, but get them actually better than where they were before. And I think that's really been my just new passion the last few years. And I know, like you mentioned, we've worked together on a lot of different ACL projects, really trying to develop a more robust, comprehensive rehabilitation, but also performance enhancement piece to our ACL athletes.
Oh, that's awesome. Let's dive in specifically to our topic. We've got probably one of the more controversial topics, except for maybe open kinetic chain exercise after ACL reconstruction, but it's the timeline for return to sport after ACL reconstruction. And this is a pretty complex issue, not only because we've got research and things like that say certain things, but it's also complex because there's so many people involved. There's the athlete, obviously, first. There's the athlete's parents. There's the coach. There's a surgeon who did the surgery. There's the physical therapist, the athletic trainer, the strength coach. And all of these people might not be on the same page. We might have a surgeon, for example, kind of saying, hey, yeah, you're good to go after 4 months or 6 months. And then a physical therapist saying, oh, wait a second, there's research that says otherwise. How big a problem is this?
It's quite the disconnect. It really is, because really the loser in the whole thing is the patient and the family. Because, you know, in my experience working, navigating all the different personalities and all the different stakeholders in this, you know, you get the physical therapist saying, okay, the timeline is probably more like 9 to 12 months, but the physician is thinking more like 6. And, you know, even if the communication between the physical therapist and the physician is good, sometimes, you know, those goals don't always match up. You know, the physician is wanting to get people back as soon as possible because, you know, obviously that looks good from their marketing and from their standpoint. And from the surgical perspective, you know, they think it looks good and they're ready to go. But from a physical therapy perspective, you know, we're not only just thinking about their knee function, but we're thinking about, you know, performance enhancement as well as, you know, not having more problems or more injuries. So again, it's quite the interesting topic for sure. So it is quite the disconnect.
Absolutely. It's we've been involved in, we get involved in it, it seems, on a very regular basis of when that disconnect occurs, particularly in leadership roles. But let's dive in. And what does the research say about, you know, ACL reconstruction, return to sport timeline? What can you highlight the takeaways from that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Cliff Notes version basically of it is it seems like longer is better. And I know that's not always the most, you know, sexy thing or whatever to kind of plaster up on the board. But, you know, if the research is very clear, 9 months kind of is your minimum. You know, it's better at 12 months. And if you've had revisions or other concomitant pathology, it may be even more than that. But, you know, there has to be a little bit of a biological healing and a process that the ACL graft has to go through. And I know that, you know, historically, you know, it was, you know, maybe more about accelerated programs and just all about criterion and just, you know, get your knee range of motion, get your basic strength. Can you run? Can you jump? Okay, go out there and play. And, you know, that's fine and that's good. And we certainly honor criteria as well. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that in this episode. But also there's the factor of there is healing and there is a process that the ACL graft has to go through. And I think sometimes we lose perspective of that timeline. It still does matter. Healing has to happen.
So now, okay, let's think about this. So if we have time, you know, obviously if time is the only factor, you could put someone in, like we did back in the 90s, believe it or not, you could put someone and cast them, you know, and not do anything with them. And they clearly would not be ready to go back to sport if whether it's 9 months or 12 months or 2 years, if you're not doing anything. But what is it biologically? You mentioned biological. What is it biologically that might be happening, or what does the research tell us about what is happening?
That's a great question. I mean, it's essentially when you go in and you put in the new ACL graft, whether you're taking a bone, patellar tendon, bone, or hamstring, or quad, whatever, it doesn't matter. But you're taking this tissue and you're replacing that ACL, and it has to undergo a true process, a healing process, and it starts out as foreign tissue to the body where there's not a lot of blood flow. There's, you know, there's not good scar tissue formed around it. There's actually good bony healing that has to occur. So really those first couple months, you know, it's almost like a fracture to some degree. You have to let the bone synthesize within the bone and solidify and mature a little bit and then something happens around that 6-8, you know, week period where you do start getting some revascularization. You start getting some more blood flow to that graft and it starts to lay down some more collagen and lay down some tissue and starts to undergo that very slow ligamentization process. It's a slow collagen buildup where the graft is actually going through a maturation phase. And again, it takes a while. It takes longer than you think. You know, some studies would say that could take up to 2 years for that process to actually even really undergo completely. Now, 2 years sounds completely absurd. Like there's no one out there that's going to say, hold our athletes out for 2 years. But what we do see is about at that 12 months, typically on average, around 12 months, you will get some pretty decent maturation of the ACL. You'll get some reinnervation of the ACL, meaning that those mechanoreceptors, those actual, you know, cells at the cellular level, if you were actually to go in and biopsy that new graft, whether it was a patellar tendon graft, at 12 months, those cells have now started that transformation into actual now ACL cells. So it's really this transformative process that's really complex. And we can disrupt that pretty easily by getting out there too early and stressing it too early.
You know, I think probably biologically, that is, you know, one of the most impressive things to me, that you can take, you know, bone patellar tendon bone graft and look at it histologically, and it looks like patellar tendon. And then 12 months later, you look at it and it looks like an ACL. My mind is blown by that concept. But one of the things I think that's maybe important to understand is, you know, we're taught in school that what is the ACL? If you asked any PT student, athletic training student, what does the ACL do? It'd be like, well, it prevents anterior translation. And we think in this mechanical terms. We just purely think like, hey, you know, you stress the ACL by a Lockman, by an anterior drawer, that type of thing. And that's what it's preventing. But what we're hearing and what we're seeing in the research is, you know, it probably actually has more of a proprioceptive phenomena, proprioceptive role than a mechanical role. Because if you denervate the leg, if you denervate the quads and you had someone walk, they would tear their ACL. So it's clearly not the only thing that's happening. Plus, we have Copers who are saying don't even need an ACL reconstruction. So clearly the muscular system can take over and needs to take over. How does that, when we change our thought process from a mechanical restraint only to actually maybe a proprioceptive organ primarily, how does that factor in?
Well, it's crazy important because, you know, I think we all would agree that some of the, you know, physical rehabilitation that we're going to do is going to be very focused on quad strength, hamstring strength, good neuromuscular control of the lower extremity and the core. Like, I don't think anyone disagrees that that is a large proponent of what our rehabilitation program is going to be. And, you know, but the thing of it is the ACL isn't just this rope in the knee that's going to tension up and stop the translation. Right? It actually is communicating with the quad and the hamstring. So and that's the funny thing about how proprioceptors just work in general is they actually work by detecting rate and change of tension. So whenever the ACL does start to tension up a little bit because of a change of direction or a rotational move or whatever, then it communicates with the quad. And if it communicates with the quad fast and quickly and accurately, the quad then engages and provides additional support to the joint, right? So obviously the quicker that communication occurs,
and you get the co-contraction. You get a co-contraction of hamstrings, all the, you know, all your pes anterior, all the different muscles kind of contract in a coordinated way then.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful system the way it's set up. And again, it provides the actual restraint that you're talking about. It's not just the ACL. The ACL is just the communicator that says, hey, everyone, come on. We got to, you know, fire and batten down the hatches because we don't want another injury.
So as we think about sum up on the research here, you know, we think about the timelines. You know, you mentioned 9 months seems to be an important cutoff. It might be 12 months. You know, what happens, according to the research, what happens, you know, as we progress? Like, why is 4 months different than 6 months at return, or 6 months versus 9 months? How is that different?
Yeah, I think it's a couple factors. I mean, for sure. I mean, certainly, we always think about, you know, honoring three big domains, right? And the research would bar this out and support this as well, as these are the big factors, the big things you need to keep in mind. It's number one, the biological healing. You've got to honor that time frame. So, and we've talked about that. But also the physical readiness does matter, right? So certainly along the way, we are hitting milestones and working on range of motion and strength and movement and, you know, balance, and all those things still definitely matter. And then we also care about the psychological readiness and the confidence that the athlete has to be able to go back out. So, you know, those are three big domains. Now, certainly the longer you wait, the more opportunity that you have to improve the physical function and enhance the confidence of the athlete. So naturally, you would think that some of those things start to come on board as you start to get 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 9 months in. So partly, you know, the reason why people tend to do a little bit better later is has a lot to do with they are having the opportunity to pass their return to sport testing and do those things and build their confidence. But you'd be surprised how even there's several studies that have barred this out, that even at a year or even a year plus, sometimes folks aren't passing. About 50% of people are actually passing return to sport criteria. So certainly, you know, that's a big factor in itself. And that kind of leads me to think about, we need to be thinking about in our rehabilitation programs, getting at some of these things sooner than we think. So that we are in that 9 month to 12 month wheelhouse and we have passed all of those physical readiness factors.
That's awesome. So now if I'm talking with a surgeon or a patient and I'm saying, you know, they're saying, gosh, you know, we're debating now between 7 months returning or 8 months or 8 months versus 9. Is there any research to support that it a month matters?
It does. It does. I mean, that was a great study that was done a few years ago. It was from the Delaware Oslo ACL cohort group. And really part of that research barred out that, you know, for every month that you delay your return to sport up to 9 months. So again, you're talking, you know, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. For every additional month that you delay, your reduction of ACL injury actually goes down 51%. So it does matter. It's very powerful, very powerful. It's just these folks are definitely a little bit of waiting, a little bit of time matters a lot. Again, getting at the biological healing, but also what's happening at that time too. To your point, they're not just sitting in a cast. They're rehabbing, right? They're strengthening. They're working on their movement patterns. They're working on their power. They're working on their agility. They're probably maybe even starting to integrate back in to a little bit of return to participation where they're doing some non-contact drills. So all that is occurring that's making them better.
That's awesome. All right. So we've talked a lot about the research here, but gosh, where our passion is and where the rubber meets the road, quite frankly, is we deal with situations where maybe everybody isn't on the same page. Can I give you some examples? These are hypothetical examples, but quite frankly, happen to us on a regular basis, of return to sports scenarios. Because if it were as simple as just wait 9 months or just pass your return to sport testing, we wouldn't even be having this podcast. But it's more complicated. So if I were to say to you, you've got a high school senior whose scholarship is on the line and they're 6 months post-op and they pass all their return to sport criteria, how would you handle it?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah, this scenario happens literally all the time. Now, and this is where I think that there is a little bit of gray built in. I've heard surgeons tell me, hey, I don't just operate in the black and white all the time. Like there's certainly extenuating circumstances. There are certainly gray areas where we have to compromise a little bit or, you know, put the patient's wishes and goals and family's goals in perspective. And so in that scenario you just laid out, you know, you're a senior, your scholarship maybe is on the line, you're wanting to go to college, you know, this, or maybe this is your high school senior and this is the last opportunity that you have to play this sport. And that's really crazy important to you. And you're safe. You know, you indicated that you're safe because you at least passed return to sport testing, right? So it's not like you're going out there with, you know, lacking 20 degrees of knee extension and you know, a 32% quad, right? Like, so you're safe, but you haven't fully gone through the ligamentization process, there's certainly some at risk added to going out there. But in those cases, I think you have the conversation with it and you let them start to get back out there and play. Now, you may need to monitor some workload. You may need to manage minutes. You may need to be smart about how you start to integrate that back in. But that's where you can kind of back off of that timeline a little bit and do what the patient, the family wants, as long as you feel like they're safe to do it.
Well, you heard it here first. Dr. Matzel says that every ACL reconstruction can go back at 6 months. No, I think that's the thing, though, is it is individual. And isn't that actually the definition of evidence-based practice? We're applying the research, but incorporating our expertise and incorporating the patient values all to combine together to give us this answer. But we can't use that at the same time as an excuse that everyone should go back at 4 months or 6 months because all the factors need to be considered. And just because one person went back doesn't mean that everybody's ready. We deal with that a lot, don't we, right? Where you're seeing people on the same team, maybe by the same surgeon, and you know, one's like, I went back at 4 months, you know?
Yeah, you absolutely. So there's a lot of peer pressure too. And you know, where, and not just with the athlete, but man, let's take it to the therapist role, the clinician role for a second. If a surgeon's standard is, and he tells, let's say the family, hey, all the ACLs I do typically get back around 6 months. And then let's say you have an athlete that you're rehabbing that is a little bit behind the eight ball on that. They are at 7 or 8 months and aren't ready and aren't going back. And you really are building more of a 9 month, 10 month, 12 month program. Well, then all of a sudden the thought is, oh, well, you're just getting bad rehab, right? Oh, the therapist isn't doing a good job, right? And that may not be the case at all. Like the rehab may be brilliant. The rehab just may be trying to honor some of those biological timelines based off, hey, this athlete is not a high school senior and isn't competing for a scholarship and is maybe in the off season. And we can slow down and pump the brake a little bit. And there is no necessarily big sense of urgency here. So the juice really isn't worth the squeeze at that point. So let's slow that down. But I do think that there then can be, when other folks don't know the backstory there, then you get the team members, you get the coaches, you get even the surgeon saying, oh, well, your therapist needs to kick it in gear. Your therapist needs to do better for you. And well, that's not always the case, right?
So context matters, right? And we know that. And I mean, no one would say it doesn't matter. So let me give you another scenario just so we can provide clarity. You've got a high school freshman who is at 6 months and they may have a little bit of anterior knee pain, but they're really wanting to go back. You know, they pass some return to sport tests. How does that factor? What does that look like?
Yeah. See, this is more of a difficult conversation with the family and with the surgeon of, listen, they're just not ready. It's the juice isn't worth the squeeze at this point. I mean, and I do think laying out that context of this is a freshman that has lots of time ahead of them for sports. You know, you miss a little bit of extra time now. That's okay. We're going to get you back better than ever for next season. And you still have time to go. It's there's too many risk factors that have multiplied and build up. It's just not worth it at that point. So I would push harder in that sense that we need more time. And, you know, just like anything, you know, risk factors, impairments, both physical, psychological, whatever, the more you have, obviously, the more risk you're putting yourself at. And, you know, just like cardiovascular risk factors, if you have, you know, 4 or 5 cardiovascular risk factors, folks start to get worried and maybe you need some intervention, right? You only have 1 or 2. You might be able to manage that, you know, lifestyle change and exercise. But musculoskeletal risk factors are the exact same way. Deidre Tehan with in the military did a great study that looked at stacking risk factors. You stack musculoskeletal risk factors up, and guess what? More risk factors equals more risk for injury. Less risk factors, less risk for injury. That's where we have to manage this from a big picture standpoint. It's you've got multiple risk factors and, you know, you've got time on your side because you're a freshman. There's no sense of urgency. Let's slow down.
That context matters. So, you know, one of the things I hear in this, though, too, that you're saying is, you know, maybe a surgeon is saying you can get back to sport at 7 or 6 months, let's say. Let's just give a common example. You know, you can get back to sport at 6 months. Does that mean, you know, do you think the surgeon means, and again, I can't speculate on that, but does that mean that at 6 months, we're hitting the ground, absolutely running full competition, you know, we're going to play in the big match of the week without having done anything before that? Or how do you see it as a continuum?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I don't think that makes any sense whatsoever. And I don't think that there's any surgeons that probably believe that's what's happening. But I do have this fear sometimes that, at 6 or 7 months in rehab, when we're pushing for more rehab, I have this fear that surgeons are thinking that we're still on the table doing quad sets and straight leg raises, though. We got to be very clear. That's not what we're doing. And certainly at that 6 month, 7 month period, your patients may very well be likely to start to get back into that return to participation phase. What does that mean? What does that look like? Well, they're not on the table doing quad sets and straight leg raises. We're well beyond that. They may be actually out on the practice field, maybe kicking the ball around, shooting some free throws, integrating back in with the team and the coach, being around, you know, and that quickly turns into non-contact drills, right? That quickly turns into low level practice drills, you know, one-on-one, two-on-two, you know, situations. And then that turns into, okay, let's try a full practice. And then let's try a full practice with full contact. And then we can maybe start thinking about some game, live game action, but we're probably going to manage your minutes. We're going to make sure we're keeping your mind your acute to chronic workload ratio, because if we ramp you up too fast, too soon, the evidence is very clear on that, that you're going to start to have problems. So we manage those factors. But really, that 6 month, 7 month, 8 month probably looks a lot like going through that progression, so that they're not just doing rehab in the clinic. They're out on the field and back to practice doing some things that look a lot like sport.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the thing. But so we talk about this continuum. You've mentioned return to sport testing. How do we use, maybe you've talked about discharge testing checklists. How do we use that to, what is that? And then how do we use that to get everyone on the same page early and often in the rehab process?
Well, it's crazy important. You've got to set expectations early. And I know you do a great job of this. You know, your website content has, you know, access to some of these checklists, and you talk a lot about it. And I know we have a MedBridge course, you know, on ACLs where we go through these checklists very early. But I think that sometimes there's a perception where the patients and the family maybe think you're just adding more tests, or you're adding more hoops, or you're moving the goalpost back as you get further. We don't want that perception. That's not what we're trying to do. But there's lots of things that we need to manage. And so those discharge checklists, integrate those early, set down day one, here's what you're going to be able to do by the end. And it go over all the domains. You're going to get your range of motion. You're going to get your quad strength. You're going to get your balance. You're going to get your basic movement, your complex movement. We're going to get you doing dynamic balance. We're going to do running, jumping, cutting, agility. You're going to feel confident and ready, and we're going to get you back out there fully, you know, vetted and ready to go to sport. And that's, I think that needs to be done that first visit. It's a discharge checklist. And then, you know, obviously it's our milestones along the way to make sure that we're hitting those. That's our physical readiness, right? So as the biological healing is occurring, we're checking off our criteria along the way too.
Yeah. So, you know, I think of it like, your discharge testing starts maybe at week two, is the way I like to think about it, right? Because we want full knee hyperextension range of motion by week two. Okay, that's a discharge criteria, you know, and balance is a category, a domain. Well, you're passing a single leg, eyes open balance is passing a discharge criteria. Is that the only balance criteria? By no means, but it is the idea that, you know, it is a stepwise, and we're constantly revisiting it and really showing them how they're marching down the field, if you will, hitting all these great milestones, and it then doesn't feel like we're moving the goalposts. Well, let's switch a little bit here. You know, we've kind of talked about the research. We've talked about, you know, this continuum of return to sport, discharge checklists. But man, these conversations are hard. So how do you have that conversation with the surgeon where, let me give you a scenario. You know, the surgeon preoperatively said, you're going to be good to go at 6 months. They might have a 6 month visit, and the surgeon says, yep, you're clear. How do you have that conversation with the surgeon? What does that mean?
Yeah, those are the toughest conversations. And I think, you know, a lot of the rehabilitation folks that have been on this call have probably been in that situation before, because as rehabilitationists, we get the opportunity of really seeing the patient every day. We get to know the patient. We get to know what their goals are, the family's wishes, the family's goals, you know, really their values. And it's harder for the physicians because maybe they don't have as much time or as much insight into that as sometimes we do. But, you know, certainly I think having a good plan in place, you know, having some testing, having some data is helpful, right? It's I think we go through sometimes in the early phases of rehab, we're so good about measuring that knee range of motion and, you know, assessing strength and balance. And we have those updated reports of, oh, knee flexion is now 120. And last week it was was 110. And, you know, there's this, you know, obviously this incremental change. And then something happens there in that kind of 6 months, 7 months, where maybe sometimes you're not testing as often and we're not testing things. And sometimes it feels like you're just in the dog days of rehab. And so I think this is where we can make sure that we are frequently checking in and testing our athletes, you know, making sure that their strength is staying good and their balance is staying good. And you know, I've had a patient before in the past where, you know, we've tested quad strength and quad strength was, you know, acceptable. It was, you know, an 80s percent on a Biodex score, which is pretty decent for, you know, where he was on his timeline. He was about 6 or 7 months out at that time. The physician really wanted him to go back and start doing some football and started, you know, giving some kicking. He was a field goal kicker. And, you know, it was probably a little early for him, but we're like, okay, you know, we can work with that. And the funny thing about it was he went out and started kicking. And, you know, 2 weeks later, we retested his Biodex. It went down 13%. I mean, so it just goes to show you that when your body isn't ready, when it's not calibrated, it'll actually hit the inhibition button and it'll to say, hey, we're not ready for that. We're going to rob you of some strength because we don't want you to go out and overdo it. So I think sometimes having those conversations.
Stay there for a second there, because I think that's an important concept that, you know, I think just even working with you that really opened my eyes is the idea that, okay, you said the person had decent enough quad strength to return, let's say return to participation level. Okay, right. They're going out, maybe doing limited contact, limited type of thing. Because, you know, again, we want to see 90-95%, but you're saying, okay, remember, this is a continuum. But they go back and then you retest them and they went down. Say that again for me. Like, why do you think, you know, again, this is level five evidence here, but why do you think that went down?
I think it goes down because the body wasn't ready to accept that degree of stress and load.
So if they just went back to straight ahead running, you don't think it would go down?
Maybe not. Maybe straight ahead running may have been at that point, that may have been an acceptable level of stress for the body to handle. That's maybe something that he had been doing in rehab. The body handles that and it doesn't see any significant decline. But as soon as you start to ratchet it up outside of the realm, you know, we would call it the razor's edge sometimes. You start getting to the end of the razor's edge, you get over the edge where the body's just, you know, it's a little bit too challenging. Then the brain starts to shut things down a little bit. It's neural inhibition. It's a neurological phenomenon. It's really, to a lesser degree, the same thing we see even after surgery, when you have this really fit, strong athlete that goes into surgery and an hour and a half later, they have no quad control, right? Certainly there's inflammation and effusion that shut that down, but it takes so long to get that quad strength back. There's a lot of a neural inhibition driving that. And it's, to a lesser degree, this is what we see here too. So it's so important to test, but also to do retesting to make sure you're hitting it. Because I think sometimes we think we're good because we've passed it once and then we start upping the ante and doing more and not even knowing that sometimes things are declining and we may be now in a red bucket. And so making the physicians aware of that, I think sometimes can help with that process of more rehab, more buy-in. They're not quite 100% ready to go yet.
You know, you bring up a really good point about that consistent retesting. You know, I had the opportunity together. We saw a patient post-op ACL reconstruction and documented him. And it was cool because it was documenting the good, the bad, the setbacks, the positives and things like that. In this particular patient, they actually didn't have any anterior knee pain their entire rehabilitation process. And, you know, we kind of want to pat ourselves on the back and say, boy, it was because of our great rehabilitation. But guess what happened at about 10 months when they're in that high level, you know, return to sport, when they're actually getting competitive in things at 10 months, started having anterior knee pain. Tell me what we found there.
Yeah, we actually found he started losing some knee extension range of motion, right? So it's you know, again, we always tout how important getting symmetrical knee hyperextension is and get it soon, get it often, you'll get it early. And again, this was a patient that did struggle a little bit early on with getting knee extension range of motion. He had had a meniscus repair too, and was non-weight bearing for a period of time. So it was a little bit of a struggle, but we got it. It was there. We had kind of moved past it into other things. And guess what happens? All of a sudden, it starts to tighten up a little bit as he starts ratcheting up more volume, right? He's back out there. He's playing sports. He's ratcheting up his volume, his minutes, his intensity. And what happens is the body says, we're going to batten down the hatches a little bit more. So again, pat ourselves on the back that we were able to test it, catch it, and get it renormalized quickly, which I think is totally fine. And I want all the therapists on this podcast to, understand that, it's okay if, you get someone's strength up and it goes down a little bit. It's okay if you fix someone's movement pattern and then all of a sudden it kicks back out. Like, don't get down on yourselves. Like, that's going to happen 100%. The mistake is not being aware that it's happening and not re-correcting it quickly. Because the longer you go without it, the worse it's going to be.
I got to say, 25 plus years into ACL reconstruction rehabilitation specialization, I learned this year that I don't know that at 10 months with someone who already had their full knee hyperextension range of motion, that I would have paid a ton of attention to it. It was the knee pain that caused us to go double check the checklist to make sure that we've gotten everything. But, maybe there is some room for just, hey, let's check these advanced things. But every so often also go back and make sure the fundamentals have stayed in place. Well, I want to talk about one last kind of concept here of when we're having these conversations. Let's have the conversation where the person comes from the surgeon. This is going to be dialed in. It's real. It's hard. Comes from the surgeon. They were released at 6 months. We talked about how to talk to the surgeon about it. They've been quote unquote released. And the surgeon says, yes, you can go back to sport. The parent and the athlete come into your athletic training room or come into your rehab facility and they say, yep, doctor said I'm good to go back. What do you say?
Yep, absolutely. It's a tough conversation for sure. And I think this is where we have to, be those second set of eyes. We have to be that differential diagnosis and that differential opinion, just like we are for a lot of things. I mean, a lot of times you have physicians that are, have done an exam or an abbreviated exam, and then they go to the PT to get a second look. I think this is our opportunity here to, make sure that we're doing our robust test battery, follow our checklist, follow our criteria, and then provide the opinion or the awareness that we need to based off the safety for the patient. So if I've got someone coming in that's got knee pain and is got a lot of risk factors and everything, then they're probably not ready and they are going to crash. They're going to go down. And I think that having those difficult conversations are really important. And the nice thing is, a lot of times the patient's parents, if you're dealing with all high schoolers here or whatever, family members are still involved, they understand that. Like, if you invite them, say, hey, come, let's do our testing, and you can observe it and see the performance and see the pain that your son or daughter is in, see the struggle with some of the tests. I think parents all of a sudden perk up a little bit and say, wow, I didn't realize that it was causing so much pain, or you were having so much difficulty with jumping on that side. Yeah, we definitely need to get some help. And once you have the patient's family and the patient in your corner, it does become a lot easier talking with the surgeons.
Absolutely. So, one of the things I see in what I hear in what you're saying is, we have to advocate for our patients. We have to advocate, particularly most of these people are minors, and we have to provide high quality information, data driven information. But push come to shove though, isn't it their decision? So how do you give that information based on data? And still, it is actually a team's decision. It is, if the surgeon says you're not returning before 12 months, and I think they're ready at 6 months, I can have the conversation with the surgeon, but quite frankly, he's driving the train on that. He's the one that did the operation. So, how do you provide that data? What does that look like? And then how do you go about letting literally specifically talking about, hey, this is the decision that you need to make with your family, your surgeon, that type of thing.
Well, it goes back to making sure you have a plan in place. I mean, I think so many of us, if we go in and just kind of do random tests or we don't do any tests, it's just more based off feel or intuition. Sometimes we can make a mistake. And I'm not saying that feel and intuition are bad. There's a lot of great experts out there that have seen it. But what I am saying is the data-driven part of it is really important because it takes the subjectivity out of it. Right. And so literally putting someone through some testing and say, hey, you do really well with range of motion, but your quad strength is down in the 60 percentile, your movement patterns are painful. You've got a big asymmetry on like a Y balance test. You know, you've got all these risk factors that are starting to stack up. Plus, you're already actively hurting. Right. So it becomes at that point, present that information to the family and giving your just opinion and recommendations like, hey, I understand that you guys want to get back. I understand that, you have your values and you have your perceptions too. Here's from our end, what we're seeing. The recommendation from our end is we can improve this. We can make this better and we can maybe, give us a month here. We can turn this around and maybe we're in a lot better place. A lot of families get on board with that very quickly when you have a plan. You actually have, here's the results, here's the plan, here's the solution. They're fine. We get in trouble when we don't have a plan and we don't have a solution. That's when I think folks lose a little bit of confidence.
I think we see a lot of patients with, anterior knee pain and at 6 months, and they're kind of in that going back. I've kind of alluded to that several times, but why does pain matter? Right. Well, it's so common after ACL reconstruction, it's almost viewed as, well, of course you have pain. You had an ACL reconstruction and you just got to kind of work through that.
Just normal. Right.
Right. Yeah. So tell me about that. Like, what does the research say that pain's going to do?
It's not normal. And what's going to happen is pain is actually going to drive more inflammation, more chemical pain and muscle and neural inhibition.
And be a risk factor. Like a huge risk factor.
Well, I mean, again, looking just at movement, like if you just look at basic, we all talk about movement quality and how movement quality is definitely one of the domains on our physical readiness that we want to make sure they have. And we measure movement quality in addition to other things. Well, what if you have pain with just movement? What if, when you just go to bend down to touch your toes or just to do a squat, what if you already are having knee pain with just that? It's not going to be long before when you're doing vertical jumping and change of direction and jumping off one leg while you're in sport, that is going to manifest itself as more pain, more swelling, and an injury, right? So, you could make an argument at that point of when they have just basic everyday pain with ADLs and basic movement, they're already hurt.
Right. Well, and there's a good amount of research that says that is probably the number one factor because that someone's going to get re-injured is because of that pain. So you've mentioned discharge checklist. Can you give it an overview of the categories and maybe some examples of tests in each of the categories from basic to more complex?
Yeah. So we talked a lot about biological healing. The physical readiness or the criterion readiness is important. It all starts day one. You've got to get range of motion back, and that's part of your discharge. So yes, we want basic range of motion, full knee hyperextension range of motion compared to the opposite side, full knee flexion range of motion. And again, we like to think of that not just, in the classic knee to chest kind of example, but also sitting back on the heels, getting full knee flexion range of motion that way. That's important too. But range of motion, basic strength, hip strength, core strength, calf strength, really important. All those things matter. Basic movement patterns, using just basic, less complex movement patterns, but also higher level movement patterns, things like, a functional movement screen or higher level movement patterns that will assess symmetry and major limitations. We look at balance a lot of different ways, from, static balance, eyes open, eyes closed, to more dynamic balance on a star excursion or a Y balance test situation, right? Where you're getting triplanar motion near the limits of someone's stability. That's a continuum for balance, right? We also start thinking about jumping, right? So, early plyometrics, starting to optimize that load. And so we want to start that process process too. And that manifests itself into horizontal hop testing, single leg hop testing, to lateral hop testing, to single leg vertical hop testing to address the power. And then certainly agility through T-tests and modified Illinois and, you know, all matters. And then really the last piece is making sure that the athlete themselves has the confidence and the readiness. And that gets to the psychological readiness. We've got to make sure they feel they could pass all the physical stuff, but if they don't feel ready and they're not confident, then that's a risk factor too.
That's awesome. So what would be your, you know, if we can leave the listeners with some actionable takeaways, what would be your top three actionable takeaways to improve practice?
It's a great question. Start the discharge checklist and the discharge checklist process early. Start it literally that first day or at least that first week. Sit down with the patient. Tell them this is where we're going. This is what you're going to be able to do at the end of this journey. And if they have a timeline, if they're like, hey, I really need to be back in 7 months, I really need to be back in 8 months, then okay, we're going to have that conversation. We're going to do everything we can to get you back on that timeline, knowing that sometimes it may be a little faster, but it might be a little slower. But we've got their timeline in sight, and we've got our plan that we're going to hit these milestones along the way. So definitely that early on. Start going after a lot of the basic movement patterns and balance risk factors sooner than you think. I think sometimes you make a mistake in rehab where we're doing table exercises for several weeks, and then we're doing, you know, kind of more proprioceptive or neuromuscular control type exercises for several weeks. And next thing you know, we're 12 weeks, 14 weeks into the rehab, and we haven't even looked at, you know, their movement and haven't even looked at like their balance. And I think that's a mistake. I think we need to start integrating that in sooner rather than later. And along with that same line of thought is think about expanding your reach to not just the knee and the hip, but also down to the ankle and the foot and the core, because we know that those all have to integrate together. So it's a great opportunity in the early phases to get your ankle dorsiflexion motion taken care of, get your hip extension range of motion taken care of. That takes stress off the knee. And then I think just, you know, as you're making communication with athletic trainers, with family, with parents, athletes, and surgeons, you know, just go into that conversation, try to disarm and de-escalate as opposed to come in, frustrated or angry. I think that never works. The times I've been frustrated with physicians and I go and I express that frustration, we don't get anything done, right? Nothing happens. So just go in with a level head, have your data, have your recommendation, and then be willing to compromise a little bit. If you don't think the athlete's ready to start running yet and the surgeon wants them to start running, how can we compromise? Can we say, what about some unloaded running? I've got access to an Alter G. Let's start some unloaded running. Can we do that for a couple of weeks? And if they do okay with that, then we'll do running. Okay, let's start that. So if you have those opportunities to compromise, and then that creates great dialogue, and again, still positively moves you in the right direction of getting the patient the care they need.
That's awesome. Those are such great takeaways. You know, you have some MedBridge courses. I'm curious as to what are some of your favorites and why?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's so many now. I mean, a lot of work on this ACL project over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years of, you know, upping your game in ACL rehab. You can find that on MedBridge. It's a great little 1 hour course that really talks about some of these principles. But if you want a deeper dive into really seeing exactly how we kind of manage this, check out our two-parter. It's a beyond the protocol of ACL rehab, and then also return to full performance after ACL reconstruction rehab. Those are deeper dives, more robust, longer courses, but really get into the weeds of exactly the timelines, the protocol, how we specifically start interjecting testing and using the testing data to make decisions on our return to play.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. How can people connect with you?
Awesome. Yeah, you can find me. KyleMatzel.com is a great way. I'm also on social media. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, you can reach out to me. But certainly I love questions. I love emails. I love connecting with folks and getting different perspectives and different thoughts. So you can always email me. Just my name, KyleMatzel@gmail.com.
Oh, that's fantastic. We sure appreciate it. You can find more information about me and what I'm up to and what I'm learning at philpliski.com. And we're just so thankful that you've joined us. We really appreciate you being here, Dr. Matzel. It's been awesome. We hope to have you back sometime.
My pleasure. I hope to be back.
Fantastic. Well, everyone, until next time, let's keep building the future of rehabilitation and performance together. Bye now. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Rehab and Performance Lab by MedBridge. Please be sure to subscribe and listen to more of our episodes on Spotify or your favorite podcast platform and at MedBridge.com. If you're listening outside of the MedBridge catalog and would like to access the bonus resources and receive continuing education credit, simply log into your MedBridge account and search for this episode to find the accreditation details. Rehab and Performance Lab also listens to you. If there's a particular clinician that you'd like to hear from, or if you have a clinical question or a challenge that you'd like to see addressed on this podcast, please let us know by leaving a comment on our Instagram posts or by emailing podcasts@medbridge.com. See you next time.